FPL wants to collect for the cost of recovery after Irma. And here come the yellow ants. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Florida Power and Light has made a request to charge customers $1.3 billion for restoring power after Hurricane Irma. They're still collecting recovery costs for Matthew. Is the utility system of collecting after a storm fair, or is it just part of the price of living in Florida? Tammy Alvarez is a photographer with the Sun Sentinel, so she has thousands of hours of video she's collected over the years. It turns out she has a video at the center of a White House controversy. We'll explain. Also, the Sunshine State is used to invasive species, whether plants or animals. Add one more. We'll talk to a University of Florida scientist who's discovered a new invasive ant. We'll learn all about the yellow ant. All of that coming up today on Sundial here on WLRN. First, the news. Welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. Well, the office of Representative Frederica Wilson of Miami-Dade and Broward counties said she planned to be back at the Capitol in Washington, D.C. this week. She had stayed away recently after receiving death threats. President Trump and his chief of staff both harshly attacked Wilson when she criticized the president's handling of a phone call to the widow of Sergeant LaDavid Johnson. He was a constituent, and Wilson is a friend of his family. Chief of Staff General John Kelly also claimed that Wilson had used the dedication of an FBI building here in South Florida to boast about her role in getting the building funded.
And a congresswoman stood up, and in the long tradition of empty barrels making the most noise, stood up there and all of that, and talked about how she was instrumental in getting the funding for that building, and how she took care of her constituents because she got the money, and she just called up President Obama, and on that phone call, he gave the money, the $20 million to build the building. And she sat down, and we were stunned.
No, that claim was not accurate, and we know that because photographer Tammy Alvarez of the Sun Sentinel had taken a video of that actual day, and so we know what the congresswoman said. Here's a piece of that.
He went into attack mode, and in 2 days, pulled it out of committee, brought it to the floor for a vote. Representative Corbell and I presented it. We all voted, and I dashed it over to the Senate.
She was talking there about the fact that they were trying to pass a resolution to name the building. Well, we're joined now by the Sun Sentinel photographer who got that video, Tammy Alvarez. Thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today. Were you following the story of White House Chief of Staff John Kelly making that claim about the Congresswoman Frederica Wilson that she had supposedly bragged about getting money for the FBI building?
Actually, I wasn't. It wasn't until a friend of mine texted me and said, hey, do you know what's going on with Kelly? And she had researched that night and found that I was at the original FBI building dedication and said, hey, you shot video. Do you think you have her speech? And normally I would just take some video of the scene and then some interviews afterwards. I wouldn't necessarily videotape an entire speech. So I told her, no, I probably don't. Well, it kind of nagged me the whole night. And so the next day on the way to work, I texted my editor and I said, listen, when I get back to the office, when I get into the office, I'm going to check my files because I save everything. And so I called up that day's videotape, and there she was.
Did you remember Representative Wilson's speech the way General Kelly described it?
No. No, I really didn't recall her speech very well, but it just didn't seem in character for Representative Wilson, who I've interacted with several times while on assignment. So when I actually saw the speech that morning, it really contradicted what he was saying, and I knew I had a scoop.
Yeah, what went through your mind when you finally watched the video?
I was like, oh my God, I have it. I have her entire speech from start to end. And so I immediately alerted my editors and started working towards posting it as quickly as I could.
And in that process, when you guys are making that decision, it's likely you're probably the only news organization that has it. What was that conversation like? What were you deciding how you were going to get that information out?
Well, we realized that we were the only ones to have this entire speech of hers on video. The reporter who was at the event that day, Linda Tichetta, had called the FBI, and they had mentioned they were getting a lot of calls from local press and national press for that video, but they weren't releasing it. So we knew we had something special, and we had something that was exclusive to us. So our first conversation was, how are we going to post this? And my suggestion, and I think everybody was unanimous in this, is we have to post it as it was shot. We have to post it raw so that there was no question as to the integrity of the video and no question that it was edited in any sort of way to skew one way or the other.
You know, this immediately spun up into a huge national story. Did you ever expect that?
I did, because I knew what we had. I knew that it contradicted what the chief of staff was saying about that event. And so we all appreciated and knew the scope of the video that we had.
What's it been like to see that work? Again, it's just you were at an event and you were taking video of a congressional leader standing at a podium, just speaking about this this moment and what this building represents. Really, it's just an everyday thing for you when you think about it. But, you know, what's it been like to now see that video that you gathered become the center of this national debate and even get a very stern response from the White House?
It's been quite unusual. Because normally my work doesn't get that much national attention, per se. But the reason why I save everything is for this exact scenario, because you never know what you shoot, how it might be needed in the future, how it might be used in the future. You never know what's going to happen with that particular person that you're videotaping or photographing. You're documenting history. So it's been exciting. It's been rewarding to know that my diligence in saving everything really has helped clarify, clarify the statements that Ms. Wilson made, and also made clear, what happened on that day.
Now, the White House doubled down in its defense of Kelly even after the video was released. Sarah Sanders said she had watched it. Did that surprise you?
No, it didn't surprise me at all, because that is what they do. They double down. And so it's not unusual in character. It's not unusual for them to do that. So I wasn't surprised.
Did anyone from Wilson's office or any other political folks from either side reach out to you or the Sun Sentinel after the video came out?
Not that I know of.
So how often do you think about the idea that, again, something you're videotaping or photographing could become national news as it's happening?
You know, when I'm out shooting, I don't think of that necessarily. I'm out documenting our community. I'm out trying to tell the truth through my images and my video, and to tell stories and give voice to the voiceless. So I'm not thinking of, is this going to make national news or what have you. But if it helps spread facts, because facts matter, then I'm really proud of what I've done.
Do you ever think about the fact, though, and we live in this world of viral videos, that everything has to go viral to get attention? Do you ever think about that when you're shooting anything?
Not really. I let people with a higher pay grade think of that for me.
All right. Again, Tammy Alvarez of the Sun Sentinel photographed. She is the photographer who photographed the video of Congresswoman Frederica Wilson back in 2015 at the FBI building that was opened. And this, again, was the center of a lot of attention because, as mentioned before, Chief of Staff John Kelly, White House Chief of Staff John Kelly, had attacked the congresswoman, claiming that she had bragged about getting the money for that building. The video came out and showed she had never done that. Tammy Alvarez, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
All right. Well, if stories of invasive species in South Florida weren't bad enough, a new one has arrived. It's not a snake. It's not a reptile. Actually, it's very, very small. That's all coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Oh, Florida, we have a new invasive species to worry about. It's not another type of snake or lizard or fish. This may be worse. It's called Plagiolepis aluati, or yellow ant. I hope I said that right. They were found in Fort Lauderdale earlier this year and may have been here for years, and they are spreading. They're not going to bite, but they can become a problem for homeowners and farmers. We're joined now by Dr. Thomas Shuvank. He is the assistant professor of urban entomology at the University of Florida Institute of Food and Agricultural Sciences. Dr. Shuvank, thank you so much for coming in.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All right. First of all, did I say that right? Is it Plagiolepis aluati? How do you say it?
Plagiolepis aluati.
Okay, good. All right. So how did you discover this new species?
I just happened to live at the right place and be there at the right time, I guess. I'm resident of Fort Lauderdale, and I've been monitoring indirectly what are the insect species in the area as part of my job. And this ant starts showing up and in my backyard, and I thought at the beginning, it's just another ant, not problem. It's like one species after another. You have to know there's more than 200 species of ants in Florida. So it's like I'm not really paying attention. I'm more focused on termite research. But then this one starts showing up on my kitchen countertop, and my wife starts complaining about it, which is understandable.
Well, of course. Come on. I don't want ants on my kitchen either.
So actually, we took it back to the lab. We started looking at it. It's like, oh, it's actually not the sugar ant. I thought it was the Tapinoma megacephala, which basically has, which is the sugar ant or the ghost ant that we tend to see in every house once in a while.
These are the tiny little ants.
They're really annoying, and usually you put the sugar bait and they come and they'll die, and you don't see them for quite a while and you're done. But this one, when I start putting the bait, hundreds and thousands of ants start coming through the countertop, and it's like, oh, this is really different. So we brought it back to the lab and identified it through the help of a colleague, Mark DeRoop, who confirmed the identification, and happened to be a tramp species, which what we call tramp species. They are species that are highly invasive and can spread in many places around the world. It originally from Madagascar area, and because of human activity of the past 200-300 years, by boats and, you know, commerce and people moving around, this hand has been displaced and spread throughout the world in the tropical area. It's a truly tropical species. So Mark DeRoop actually thought it might just be a matter of time before it shows up in Florida, because the temperature is right and the traffic that we have of people coming in and out and the commerce and everything, the tourism, it should be here anytime.
I wanted to know that moment, by the way, when you knew what it was, and you guys understood, oh, great, okay, so it's finally arrived in Florida. Like, what was that moment? What happened?
The moment was not, oh, great, by the way. It's like, oh,
this is not that great.
Well, it's a new record, so it's the first record in continental United States, so it's always kind of fun to say, hey, there's something new showing up, but we have to look at the long-term impact of what this ant is going to do. And the first thing that came to my mind is like, okay, how invasive it is and how can it be a problem to people and how can it be a problem to the industry of and agriculture? Because you have to look at the impact both for domestic situation, but also ecosystems and agriculture.
Let's describe this ant, because as you said, you thought at first it was like the sugar ant.
Yes.
That was very, very, very small. But, you call it the yellow ant. Is it because of its color?
Yes, actually, when you put them side by side, you realize that the sugar ant has a dark head. And the little yellow ant is actually completely yellow and actually much smaller, even smaller than the sugar ant. So it's what it does when it comes and finds a food source on your kitchen countertop, like you forgot a piece of jam when you're doing your PJ sandwich. And that little drop, eventually the population of ants in the area, they will find it and form very large trails of foragers coming back and forth. And what surprised me, they actually bring also queens with them. This species has is very interesting in a way that it creates super colonies, which means that you have multiple queens within the colony that lay a lot of eggs, and all the colonies that are established within the environment are all interconnected, and they all create a network of colonies. So what happens is if you kill, let's say, one arm of a monster, it's going to grow another one very quick. So what I've been doing is trying to use the regular bait you find out there. You can buy in commerce the sweet things. And they'll come, and they'll die, and they won't show up for a few days, and then they start showing up somewhere else. And I kill it, and they start showing up again and again and again. And I realize that when I go outside, this population has built up over time, and it's literally millions of ants out there, and there's little I can do at this point. It's fairly frustrating.
Well, you, first of all, you said super colony, so that already is uncomfortable to hear. Real quickly, the other thing too in describing it, so it's not an ant that's, it's not going to bite you. It's not going to harm you.
It's so small, even if it tried to bite you, you won't even feel a thing. It doesn't have a stinger either. It's in the Formicid family. So it's, at this point, a nuisance. It's just really annoying when it's all over a countertop. But beside this, it's just like another ant in your house.
And I'm glad, by the way, that you didn't bring any here just in case. We didn't need to see them. We can always look up a picture of that. All right, so you talked about, really, again, what the damage that this could do to agriculture and the nuisance that it could be to homeowners. Let's start with the homeowners again. So really, in this case, again, it's not a threat to you. It's not going to bite you. It's not going to hurt. It's just that it's going to be everywhere. Is it easy to get rid of, though? Can I just call the exterminator?
They can come and spray around your house to knock down the population. I think this is probably the best solution that we have to keep the population as low as possible outside, because the ants will come inside your house when the population reach such a large density where they're looking for additional food, because they already ate everything in the environment that they can find, and they'll look for more to grow even bigger. So this is where they're going to start showing up in your house. So I think this ant's probably been there for years in the neighborhood, but was completely undetected. First, because it's so small and the density was too low to be noticeable. And it took an entomologist to be there at the right place, the right time to, oh, this is different. So, it may have been there for years until really now I realize it's really dominant and actually has displaced other ant species, which is even more remarkable.
Yeah, is it a threat to other species? So we think about invasive species and we tend to hear stories about, well, they are also not only eating the food for normal Florida species, but they're even eating those species. But are these yellow ants a threat to other species of ants or other creatures?
The interesting thing with ants, invasive ants, as they come up, usually do a big wave and dominate and then settle down and be part of the background. So it's going to be a big flush and then it's going to be mixed with many other species. But initially we've seen this with a bigoted ant, with a Argentine ant, with a white-footed ant. Many other species, they come and they conquer. And then they settle down and many other species are, it's like a mosaic of species. Now, we have more than 50 invasive species of ants in South Florida and Florida as a whole. So we've seen one after another coming, being a problem and remain a problem, but some more than others.
All right, super colonies. Now, help us understand what a typical ant colony is so that we get a picture of what the super colony is. But what's a typical ant colony?
So if you look at a small colony of a ghost ant, though, of a sugar ant, they're going to be discrete colonies. They're going to be each colony is going to have one or two queens. They're going to be independent and not connected to anything else in the environment. While these guys, presumably because they came from a single origin, so genetically they're all brothers, sisters, cousins, they all smell the same. So they don't recognize other colonies as potential competitors or enemies. They all recognize as we're part of a big family. So when two different colonies find each other during the foraging behavior, they say, hey, you're part of my colony, and the colony will fuse, and you're going to have basically multiple sub-colonies, satellite nests, all interconnected with many, many queens in each of these independent satellite colonies. And this is where the concept of super colony emerged. And basically what we have is one gigantic organism, actually.
And it's multiple queens, and so it's. I always wondered, how does that work exactly? Usually you think one queen rules all. This is a super colony, many queens, so it seems like a big mega city.
It's pretty much what it is, and we've seen this before with the Argentine ant in California and within the Mediterranean basin in Europe, where that's invasive species come, and you can take one species from Portugal and one individual from Portugal and drop it in Turkey, and it's going to be, hey, you smell the same. I'm part of your colony. It's one gigantic colony from Turkey to Portugal. And if you go to California from north to south, it's one gigantic network of colonies. This is why we call it super colonies, because, well, it's you don't have one colony you can kill and you don't have to worry, because this is connected to a bigger thing behind.
All right. We're talking with Dr. Thomas Chovanc. He's the assistant professor of urban entomology at UF. And we're talking about this new invasive species, the yellow ant. Again, it's not going to be anything that's going to hurt you. It's not going to bite you. It's not going to attack you. But they come out in thousands, as he's mentioned. He's caught them in his house, and they are a nuisance. What about agriculture? What's the threat to agriculture in Florida? Because we already have plenty of problems here.
Oh, yes, we do. We have our share of problems in agriculture with a citrus problem and many others. But in this case, it's still very speculative. What we know, when a new ant comes up, it displaces other species and interact with the existing ecosystem. In this case, these ants are really good at tending to aphid, scale insects, and mealybugs. And many of these insects are pest problem in agricultural crops and also for ornamental plants. So what's happening is, if they come, they can increase the density of scale insects and mealybugs and aphids, which cause damage to the plant and potential reduce the production of a plant. So what you may have is, if the ant is present, it can increase indirectly other pest problems. And if this shows up in a tree nursery, then it can, my fear, if it's finally finds its way to some tree nursery in South Florida, and they're all over the state, is that if it can find their way in a potted plant, they can establish a whole colony in one single pot and be transferred to basically anywhere else in South Florida, into somebody's backyard, who they just wanted to plant a new plant. But they inadvertently bring a new ant species and ant colony in their area. So that's something I think we have to look down and monitor the spread over time, because right now we have like ground zero where we found it here. But at this point, I didn't get a chance to look beyond all of this. It may be already somewhere else too in Florida, but nobody really looked into it.
After you find this, I mean, once you figure out this is a new invasive species and now it's going to be a growing problem, at what point do you start talking to farmers, to the agricultural industry, to say, look, this is what we found and this is how it works and this could be a threat to you? And I mean, I wonder if you had that conversation yet.
We don't have documentation yet that it's going to be a problem, but looking at what happened with previous invasive species, we've seen patterns, so we can potentially predict what's going to happen. And knowing that they're so good at doing this symbiosis with pests, other pest insects, then here a prediction can be more of a, I really think it's going to happen, because we've seen this in some part of Australia, in Hawaii, and where this ant is already established, and some island in the Caribbean where it's already established. And we know that some of these scale insect mealybugs can be associated and do additional damage. So I don't think it's going to dramatically change the dynamic of the way we do with pest insects, because it's just another ant on top of all the other ones that already are a problem and can also potentially impact agriculture. So I don't think it's going to be a major change. We're just going to have to maybe readjust to the new norm. And it may just be a small lateral step. It doesn't have to revolutionize the whole industry as a whole. I don't think so.
So I wasn't kidding so much at the beginning, but when you make this discovery, I mean, there's got to be a part of you that gets a little bit excited, like, wow, all right, we made a discovery. But of course, it's bad news. So I mean, just as a researcher, as a scientist, how do you feel when you make that discovery and say, yes, we were the first to find this, but oh no, this is going to be a problem?
Yeah, well, there's always a little price of, hey, I found something new. But I mean, this is part of our job as entomologists, and especially here when we're dealing with a lot of invasive species, it's just one after another. And I've been working for a decade now in Florida to work with some invasive termite species, so I'm used to that. But the discovery itself was kind of definitely exciting. But the scientist behind me is just telling me, like, there's something we have to do now. Like, okay, the excitement maybe lasted 5 minutes, and like, move on and let's look at what can we do now.
Is there any place in the world where you don't have the issue of invasive species? I mean, you said it earlier. I think it's interesting that, you know, after hundreds of years of human beings now just traveling around the world and, you know, not just, you know, doing commerce with other countries, but traveling as tourists, that really we've visited almost every place. That means we've probably brought everything with us. But is there any place where, you know, you don't have an issue of invasive species, or it's just part of life? It's just the way it is now.
No, it's part of a globalization of commerce and movement of people. There's very little places now in the world where we don't have invasive. We're homogenizing the ecosystem where we go because we bring new species with us, not by on purpose sometimes, most of the time at least. And what do they establish? And they change the ecosystem slightly or dramatically sometimes. And can be a problem to entire economies. And we see this with the citrus industry now, with essentially, which is dramatic here as a problem. So not all invasive will be as problematic, but they can still be a nuisance, as is in the case there. And yeah, we've been moving them around. It's little we can do with this. It probably came up on a plant on the yacht, is what we think. It's probably what happened.
So you got me thinking now the next time I take a trip, I'm going to look at my luggage very, 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 very carefully.
Absolutely.
Dr. Thomas Shivank, again, he's the Assistant Professor of Urban Entomology at the University of Florida Institute of Food and Agricultural Sciences. And again, they discovered a new invasive species in South Florida, the yellow ant. Learn more about it. We'll have it up on our website later today at WLRN.org. Dr. Shivank, it's been a pleasure, man. Thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All right. Coming up, we're going to take a look at FPL wants to add on fees to your bill for Hurricane Irma recovery. We'll find out why. That's coming up on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Florida Power and Light is seeking money from customers for the recovery costs brought on by Hurricane Irma. They made that announcement last week. They're trying to recoup $1.3 billion from Irma costs. Now, they have to go before the Public Service Commission with that a proposal, and they're already in the middle of hearings with the commission about an expansion of their nuclear reactors at Turkey Point. Is the cost fair, or is it just part of doing business in Florida? Let's start off with a conversation with Peter Robbins of FPL. Mr. Robbins, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure, Lewis. Thanks for having me.
All right, so what is FPL asking of its customers in relation to Hurricane Irma damages?
Yeah, I mean, you said it just a moment ago, and you're right. You know, as we look at this storm, it was the most devastating and costliest storm in the state's history. I mean, it affected every single county that Florida Power and Light serves, and there wasn't a single pole or wire that didn't get the rains and winds from this storm. So as we announced last week, as you mentioned, we're going to seek to recover about $1.3 billion. That's our preliminary estimate at this time. We have a storm reserve fund, but that was fully depleted last year when we had two hurricanes. We had Hermine, which was really the northern part of our service territory, and then Hurricane Matthew. And look, you know, the system is built up so that we, as you said, we go to the Public Service Commission on this. We ask them to recover this fund. It's reviewed very carefully. It's not part of base rates. It's not part of our, you know, month-to-month electric rates. It's treated separately for that reason so that there's public attention and scrutiny, and we make sure this is closely examined.
Can you tell us a little bit about that reserve fund? I mean, you know, how do you plan that out? Is it per hurricane season or over a span of years?
Well, ideally, it's over the span of years. It's something that you can sort of gradually accumulate some funds in a reserve fund and have them available and ready. But in a situation like we had certainly in 2004 and 2005, when you have multiple severe hurricanes, and then in the past 2 years, where again, three severe hurricanes, with Irma being by far the most severe, what we typically would do is look for a specific charge on customer bills to recover the expenses of restoring electricity, and that's a temporary thing. These charges come and go once the storm is paid for, so it is something that is for a specific duration in time and you know, that specifically goes to pay for those costs.
But
you know, for Irma, I'm sorry, go ahead.
How is that reserve fund filled up, though? I mean, if I look, can I look at my bill and see where, it, you know, any of that money is going into that reserve fund to prepare for the future?
Yeah, it is from customers, correct. So it is an item on bills, and, you know, the specific storm charge is an item on bills as well. So as we look at Irma, you know, right now the surcharge for storms is $3.36 for the typical FPL customer. And as we look at what we expect to recover for Irma, we would expect that monthly charge to go from $3.36 to about $4. So it's about a 64% increase, because the Hurricane Matthew charge that customers have been supporting now, we expect that to end in March of this year, coming up here in March of 2018. So it is something that changes over time as storms kind of come and go and the expenses are paid for.
Do you see the possibility of maybe increasing that Hurricane Reserve Fund so that there wouldn't be any post-storm charges like this one now? Is that a possibility at all?
You know, I suppose it's a possibility, but generally these storms, particularly these severe ones, having a storm reserve built up that much to pay for a storm that, say, is $1.3 billion, really isn't the way we set things up. We find it just a little easier and easier on our customers to pay for those storms over time after they hit. So for a charge like this, for a $1.3 billion, you know, our plan would be to ask the Public Service Commission to approve it. It would come on bills starting in March of 2018, and generally stay on the bills until that $1.3 billion is collected. You know, you can estimate restoration costs beforehand, but really every storm is different, and you don't necessarily truly know what's going to be spent on a storm restoration until you're in the thick of it. And then until after it's over and you've had time to analyze, you know, the men and women that we had to call in and the work that they had to do and the cost of the actual physical restoration.
Now, we had a span of time there, over a little over a decade, where Florida was lucky and we didn't get anything. We had Wilma and then everything just went quiet for a while. And then last year we had Matthew, and again this year we had Irma. Really, during that span of time when it was, again, relatively quiet, no hurricanes hitting the state of Florida, what was going on at that point in again, that reserve fund, in building up that reserve fund? Was it building up big enough to handle multiple storms?
Well, you know, I think it's important to remember that, you know, the storms from 2004 and 2005, we structured it so our customers paid back the money for those storms gradually over time, and it was over a period of more than a decade. So the 04 and 05 storms, I think it's important to remember that even though we weren't having storms at that time, we were still paying down the cost of restoring electricity after those storms. So it's something we dealt with all the, you know, regularly, and, you know, the storm fund is just not capable of paying for something like a Hurricane Irma restoration, which is why we have this mechanism. We go to the Public Service Commission, we walk them through the expenses in the form of a filing so they can scrutinize the expenses, and then we go from there in terms of customers paying back those charges.
Again, we're talking with Peter Robbins of Florida Power and Light, and we're talking about, again, they are going to the Public Service Commission and asking them to be able to put a fee on our bills coming up next year, and this is to pay for post-Irma recovery. Again, the commission has to make the decision. Mr. Robbins, real quickly, what will that mean in our bills? It doesn't start till March.
Well, yeah, let me be clear. So right now customers are helping pay down Hurricane Matthew. The average customer, that looks like $3.36 a month.
And that ends in February.
Correct.
Okay.
That ends actually technically in March, but correct. So
okay.
We would expect that would end at the end of February, early March, and then we'll be filing with the Public Service Commission asking for them to allow Irma recovery to begin in March of 2018, which would be about $4 for the average customer. So the Matthew charge comes off, the Irma charge would start, and it would be a net increase for the typical residential customer of about 64 cents a month. So that's where we would start out.
And then in 2019, that could go up.
Potentially. You know, we're still looking at our total expenditures here in restoring electricity for folks. And our initial estimate is that it will go up roughly an additional $1.50 a month in 2019. And, you know, but again, these are surcharges specific to restoration after Hurricane Irma. in which, you know, we had 90% of our customers lose power and mobilized the biggest restoration workforce we've ever had. So it was truly a massive hurricane and a massive restoration effort to get folks reconnected as quickly as we could.
I'd imagine after the announcement, though, last week, I mean, you probably heard from customers. They probably had questions. Some of them may have been angry, but, I mean, what are you telling them?
Well, look, I mean, at the end of the day, folks want to know, what does this mean for my bills? And you know, what is the path forward for this? We do know the one time we absolutely always hear from customers is after a hurricane. And their message is, we want our lights back on. So restoration and speedy restoration is absolutely a priority for us. We were able to restore half of our customers after Hurricane Irma in a day. And we reduced the amount of time the average customer was out compared to Hurricane Irma. We basically cut it in half. So we know it's important to our customers to have that restoration workforce ready to go, to have the men and women in the field restoring power and to get their lights back on as quickly as possible. And we always try to prioritize that with watching every dollar extremely closely so that when we get to this point, when we're asking customers to support the storm restoration, they know that, you know, we watch their money very, very carefully, and we also got their lights back on as quickly as we could.
Is there any reason to believe that the commission will not approve this?
You know, I think that's really up to the commission. I don't want to try to speak for them, but what I can say is, you know, our restoration effort was extremely large, and we do believe it was the largest restoration of customers in the shortest amount of time, certainly that we've ever had, and one of the largest restorations in our nation's history. So hopefully our customers appreciate, you know, that it was a mammoth effort that we took very, very seriously. We invested in our system prior to Hurricane Irma to try to minimize outages and, most importantly, reduce the time that people would be out of power. And the numbers bear out that story that, you know, we were able to reconnect a great deal of customers very, very quickly, and the investments we made in our system paid off.
Does it matter, though, that you also have a request to charge customers for $200 million for cleanup of groundwater contamination at the Turkey Point nuclear plant? That's also before the commission. Is there any concern that having that there as well could hurt the efforts on Irma cleanup?
You know, again, I don't want to speak for the commission, but, you know, we think, you know, our customers want this situation corrected, and so do we. So, again, it's about making sure that we take care of the situation and also watching every customer dollar. You know, interestingly, the Turkey Point situation you described is part of a separate item on bills for environmental cost recovery, not to get too technical. But that's a package of different things, and as we look at that particular charge on customers' bills, even with Turkey Point next year, that portion of customer bills is expected to go down, a decrease of about 85 cents a month. So, you know, it is a large project. It's over approximately a 10-year period, but we're watching it very carefully, and that portion of customer bills, again, is expected to go down next year.
All right. Again, I'm talking with Peter Robbins of FPL, and again, discussing that the utility company is going before the public commission, Florida Public Commission, to ask for the right to increase rates. This is to pay for Hurricane Irma recovery, the bill for recovery afterwards. And again, that is $1.3 billion for customers. Mr. Robbins, stick around. We're going to take a quick break here, come back, continue this conversation. This is Sundial on WLRN. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Again, talking about Florida Power and Light, and again, seeking money from customers in recovery costs brought on by Hurricane Irma. I want to turn things over now to J.R. Kelly. He's with the Office of Public Counsel. Again, this is the group that stands up for and defends utility customers in cases like this. Mr. Kelly, it's great to have you back. Thanks so much. Well, first of all, your response, your take on this request by FPL.
Well, first off, they are entitled under Florida law to recover expenses that are directly attributable to named storms or hurricanes such as Hurricane Irma. And am I surprised at the $1.3 billion price tag? No, not really. We knew it was going to be extremely large because of the magnitude of the storm. And they're entitled to file. They filed an estimate. And I want to make sure people understand it's only an estimate at this point. There's been no evidence filed, no testimony, to support the figure. And under the law, Florida Power and Light will be able to put the surcharge on, as Mr. Robbins was discussing earlier. And then at some point later next year, they will file their final accounting. And at that point in time, our office, as well as any other interveners, will be able to fully vet the evidence and ensure that the full $1.3 billion, or how much the final price tag is, was 100% attributable to the storm and not part of normal operating and maintenance or capital expenditures.
Now, do you have a problem at all with that $4 a month for 12 months, which would start in March, and then might increase again in 2019?
Well, when you say, do I have a problem, I never like to see a customer's bill go up. However, it is part of our rate-making mechanism, rate-making mechanism here in Florida. And the $4 was a negotiated amount in a settlement back in 2009. It's been carried forward in some subsequent settlements. And we do believe that's a fairly, it is a fair figure. How did we come to it? It was part of negotiations. It could have been higher, could be lower, but we thought it was fair and we agreed to it.
All right, so what do you plan to bring before the commission in challenging this?
Well, we don't know what we'll bring forward because it'll all depend on what Florida Power and Light files. For example, we know that Hurricane Matthew hit a year ago. Well, Florida Power and Light just filed 2.5 weeks ago for a final accounting for Matthew, but they still have not filed any evidence or any supporting documentation or any testimony. So we've got to wait till they file evidence before you can begin your due diligence. Our office will then start the legal process of filing discovery questions, discovery requests for production of documents, et cetera. And then once we can vet those amounts, and we will certainly have some of our in-house accountants look at it, as possibly some outside accounting consultants. And at that point in time, anything that we feel is not reasonable or prudent, we will challenge.
All right. So as I mentioned before, too, with Mr. Robbins at FPL is currently in front of the commission for a couple of other big asks. First, the utility is asking the commission to approve another fee, this one for cleanup of the groundwater contamination at Turkey Point. Does FPL's request for Irma recovery impact the cleanup fees or vice versa?
No, so those are two separate charges. You have the storm recovery, as if we've previously discussed, and then the Turkey Point contamination cleanup is totally separate. It is part of the environmental cost recovery annual proceeding. Our hearing was held last week, and we have contested what Florida Power and Light is asking for. Our position on behalf of the ratepayers is that Florida Power and Light knew or should have known that they were causing the salinity pollution from the operation of their cooling canal system, and therefore it is certainly not fair or prudent or reasonable to come and ask the ratepayers to pay for their pollution activities.
You know, we spoke to you really within the last few weeks about FPL's performance before, during, and after Irma, and I wondered if anything has changed about your critique.
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
Yeah, we spoke to you a few weeks ago about FPL's performance before, during, and after Irma, and I'm just wondering if anything had changed about your critique.
No, sir, because, again, nothing has been filed. We will not be able to give any kind of a critique or position until we can see some evidence, documentation, financial or otherwise, as to exactly what activities Florida Power and Light engaged in response to the storm. The Public Service Commission has announced a generic docket. They're going to be looking at these activities. However, there has been no gathering yet of any data or any evidence, so it's just too preliminary at this point to take any type of a position.
What are some of the bigger complaints or concerns that you're hearing from customers?
I think some of the bigger ones about Hurricane Irma were communications. Florida Power & Light has the ratepayers have paid over the years for what was touted to be a robust communication system that we received quite a number of calls, the Public Service Commission has as well, that it failed, that the communication system told some people, yes, you have power back on at your home. And they check out of the hotels, they went home, lo and behold, they had no power. They call the utility. Utility says, we show you have power, and the customer says, well, we don't. Those are some concerns we're certainly going to look into. And in addition is we'd like to focus on exactly what caused outages. Was it equipment failure versus a tree becoming uprooted and blowing into a power station or lines and knocking them down? Those are the kind of forensic evidence that we're going to have to see in order to gauge the response or the adequacy of Florida Power & Light's response to the hurricane.
I want to turn things back over now to Peter Robbins again. He is with Florida Power & Light. Mr. Robbins, I wanted to ask you this one question we did get from a listener. Their response, this is from a Jeffrey Salter, and he says, basically, we wanted to ask about auto deductions of customers who lost power during the hurricane or they lost their homes. And he says that he was without power for 12 days and that his FPL bill was higher than last year, and they said that they billed him based upon estimated usage from last year. And so that's his basic question, is about this issue of auto deductions. What can you say his comment?
Yeah, the bottom line for him and all your listeners is that you will only pay for the electricity that you actually used. So in the cases where customers get an estimated bill because of the way their billing cycle fell with regards to the storm, if their estimated bill is higher than their actual usage, we will make that up to them on it, so they only actually pay for their electricity usage. So that's the way that works. So I understand when folks get a bill, if they say, well, it was higher than last year. That obviously the weather has a lot to do with that, first of all, if the days you are using your electricity that's particularly hot, which it was around Irma. But most importantly, if we estimate a customer's bill and it winds up being that estimate is higher than their actual usage, when we do read the meter, we make up the difference to them.
And is that automatic, making up the difference to them? Is that automatic, or do they have to call you and get that resolved?
No, they don't have to call. It's something we take care of automatically.
Again, we've heard from listeners who have asked the question about, you know, all these different fees that FPL is looking for from their customers, whether it's Irma or, again, it's an environmental issue. Next Era Energy, that's the company basically that owns you, right?
Correct. Okay. Yeah, Next Era Energy.
So, you just paid out dividends to them. Really, right now, people are looking and saying, hold on a second. You guys look like you're doing well. Why all the extra fees?
Yeah, first of all, the first thing I would say is, if you're an FPL customer, you have a bill that's about 25% below the national average. And in addition to that, you probably have one of the cleanest energy portfolios in the country. So I think that's an important starting point for people to remember, that your FPL bill is about 25% below the national average. Secondly, what we're talking about here in terms of Irma, as Mr. Kelly said, this is related to the actual cost of the restoration and the restoration process. So, I certainly wouldn't characterize this as an extra fee. This is something that we're proposing strictly to pay for costs incurred to get folks' lights back on after Hurricane Irma.
All right, I'm going to have to end it there because I'm out of time, but this is an issue that, again, we'll come back to. And as mentioned before, this is going before the Public Service Commission, so nothing has been decided just yet. I want to thank Peter Robbins again of FPL and J.R. Kelly from the Office of Public Counsel. And that is the end of our program for today. Thank you so much for tuning in and listening. You can always find us on Facebook. Look up WLRN Sundial or tweet us at WLRN Sundial. Thanks again for listening. I'm Luis Hernandez. We'll talk tomorrow.